in just a moment. It is a blessing to be here with you and to see so many here, especially visitors, and what an encouragement your presence is. I know to the group here, to me as well. And I do hope that if there are any questions about any things that we look at and study together, that you would bring those questions. There's nothing more that preachers like better than to talk about the things that they've been studying. And so we delight in those opportunities. We began last night with a series of lessons on the prophets of the Old Testament that I want to take through the week. We're just taking snippets, just lessons from the prophets here and there. We're not doing anything comprehensive. We couldn't. We've got a week. And so what I hope to do is just sort of whet your appetite. I hope to give you enough pieces where you say, well, I'd like to know more about that. And maybe give some encouragement among our brethren to spend more time reading from the Old Testament than maybe we do sometimes. I think sometimes we lack motivation. Maybe we don't get as much in the first or second or even third readings. And then maybe we think, well, I'd rather go spend time where I at least know what's being said. And so I hope that these lessons will be helpful along those lines. It's one of the things that's been helpful to me. I'll just be very frank with you in my studies, in the efforts that I've made on my own. I've become frustrated at times, and I have shied away from passages and parts of the Bible that I find difficult. One of the things that Brother Waldron told me when I first asked him what I need to do to be a better preacher, what I need to do to be able to preach like you. And he said, well, first thing he said, there's 1,189 chapters in the Bible. All you need to do is figure out what's in every one of them and commit it to memory. Okay. And so when I got done with that, so I said, well, what else? And he said, you need to go preach from books you don't know anything about. Now, he didn't mean preach when I didn't know anything about it, but go know something. Go learn something about it. And when we would study together, he would ask me questions and he would say, now you see this here? Do you see how this connects to this? And I would say, oh, no, I don't see that at all. And he said, well, let me show you. And then he would show me those connections. And it was like something that Brother Holly says very frequently when we're studying together, we're talking about prophets. He said it's like setting waypoints when explorers would go out into uncharted territory. They'd go out a little ways, and especially like when they were trying to explore the North Pole. They'd go a little bit farther, and they'd set themselves a camp up, but then they'd have to go back. And then they'd come back, and they're going over familiar territory now, so they go a little bit farther. And I hope that's what we're doing in the prophets this week, that what we're doing is we're just setting up waypoints in all of these prophets that we're looking at. And when you come back, you say, well, at least this part's familiar. Maybe I can press a little bit farther into those books all along the way. And that kind of process has helped me in my studies, and I hope that's helpful to think about for you as well. In the book of Hosea, we are not going to deal with the whole book. It's several chapters. It's one of the more lengthy minor prophets. Some of the minor prophets, like we looked at Joel, it's just a few chapters. Obadiah is just one chapter. And a lot of them are very short. That's why they're called minor prophets, in fact. But Hosea and Zechariah, which are two of the minor prophets we're going to look at this week, have a lot to say, more so than others. In fact, they have more chapters than Daniel, or Zechariah has more chapters than Daniel. Daniel just fits more words into each one of his chapters. That's why he gets major status, and these two are minor prophets. It's certainly not because the words are any more or less important than each other. Hosea, in the first three chapters, I think is some simple reading. Or at the very least, it's easier to get to than some of the other things that he has to say. It's a story. It's narrative. And as we've already talked about, the narrative of any portion of Scripture is easier to read. But just because it's narrative doesn't mean we always just easily understand why that narrative is there, what the point of that narrative is. And so I want to look at those first three chapters this evening and the position that God puts Hosea in and what he means by all of that. As far as time frame, Hosea is prophesying. He tells us when he prophesies, unlike Joel. We can more firmly establish his timing because he says he's prophesying during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. And during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now then, that is not the first Jeroboam. That's Jeroboam the second. And that is not the Jeroboam we talked about last night, the Jeroboam of the southern kingdom. You know, the king's names are hard enough to memorize without having to double up on them. But they do. And you've got the same name up here that you've got down in the northern kingdom that you got in the southern kingdom. So, and especially after Jehoshaphat and Ahab make their alliance, then it gets a real mess because, you know, when families get together, they start naming one another after each other. And so you got some of that going on. So the Jeroboam here has no relation to the first Jeroboam of the northern kingdom. In fact, this Jeroboam is in power in the northern kingdom at probably its peak of wealth and success, and it's their last enjoyment of that success before they go downhill. But again, Hosea is really not focusing his message to the northern kingdom. He's focusing to the southern kingdom. Now we got Joel that did that. He focused his message to the southern kingdom. We got Hosea doing that. Isaiah does that. You know, Isaiah's prophesying right during the time when the northern kingdom is about to be taken away, and indeed during the time when they are taken away. And his message is largely, mostly, to the southern kingdom. Now, why do you think that is? I think that one of the reasons we find that to be the case is that Israel, the northern kingdom, went so fast and so hard in the wrong direction. There's very little effort made. There is some effort. You know, we've got Elijah and Elisha, who are two of the most formidable prophets in the Old Testament. So it's not like God makes no effort. But it's sort of like God uses the inevitable, because they're past the point of no return. He uses the inevitable to try to at least salvage the southern kingdom. And so while the northern kingdom's fallen, God is sending prophets to the southern kingdom to say, do you see what is happening? Do you see where they're headed? That'll be the same direction you're headed if you don't straighten up. And so that seems to be the focus of Hosea's message. Well, beginning in chapter 1 and verse 2, we see God give one of the more interesting instructions you'll ever see God give someone in the scriptures. When the Lord says, it says, when the Lord first spoke to Hosea or through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take for yourself a wife of harlotry, and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. And so he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. We'll look at those children in just a moment. So God tells Hosea, go marry a prostitute. Now, everything I read all through Scripture says this is the very thing you want to avoid if you're somebody looking for a spouse. We preach about that all the time. So what on earth could that mean? I tell you what, when you see God commanding something that you don't think God would normally command, no doubt he's trying to say something. And obviously he's trying to say something through the instruction that he gives to Hosea. Well, she conceives to bear him a son. And the first, God gives him the names of all of his sons. The first name, it says, name him Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. And I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Well, the first son then represents some level of judgment that's coming. And in fact, it's coming to a king of the northern kingdom. Jehu, if you recall, he is the king that God instructed. He wasn't a king at the time, but he was the king that through Elisha was instructed to go and wipe out the house of Ahab. And he does that, and he does that in the Valley of Jezreel, essentially, wiping out Ahab's sons, all of the generations, the whole house of Ahab in the Valley of Jezreel. Well, that would be a good thing, wouldn't it? I mean, doing what God says. But of course, Jehu betrays God, and he doesn't do all that God commanded him to do. He does, in fact, in addition to wiping out the house of Ahab, wipe out the prophets of Baal. He has this party where he says all the prophets of Baal come, and they come into that place. And then he says, now let's make sure we get all those who are not prophets of Baal to leave here, because we want just the exclusive members of this party to be here. And then they take out their swords and they kill every one of them. So you think Jehu must be righteous in God's eyes. But it says that he only took the people back to the point of Jeroboam's departure. That's the first Jeroboam's departures. And so God's still upset with him. And so here's a reminder that he's going to bring that judgment. It's a reminder of betrayal. You sort of do what God says, but not really. And so that's put up into the face of the ones who would read this, who would hear this story. Well, she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I would ever forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. When she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. All right, so we've got Jezreel. That reminds us of the judgment that's coming to Jehu. Now what about Lo-Ruhamah? Well, Lo-Ruhamah is a little bit of what we said last night when we were talking about Joel. That is, I will not have compassion. Israel has a very long, significant history of not thinking God will do to them what he says he'll do to them. Now that carries all the way into the New Testament. That's Paul's whole point. Judgment's coming to the house of Israel, and they're like, well, not us. I mean, we're God's chosen. And he says, no, you too. And so here is a reminder, no, I will pull back my compassion. And so the salvation, the sparing that he has done for the nation, he will eventually reach that point. We see a lot of that language really ramp up in the book of Jeremiah as all hope is removed of any salvation for Jerusalem. But we see that language beginning here in Hosea, that there will be no compassion. Then verse 9, and the Lord said, name this son that she's given birth to. Name him Lo-Ammah, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. And so now we have a child who probably represents the very nature of the way that Gomer is living, the way that Hosea's wife is living. She's a prostitute. Well, whose son is it? Probably not Hosea's. And God says, you're not mine. Now again, here are people who think that no matter what they do, they're still God's people, because after all, they're still children of Abraham. They still got the genealogy. They know whose tribe they're from, and they got all of that. Again, that carries over into the New Testament. Apostle Paul would use that language, tribe of Benjamin. You know, I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews. And God says, look, I know that's what you think, but you're playing the harlot. And what that means is you're not really my people. Just because you think you're not my people doesn't mean you are my people. I just want to ask you, are there people today who think that doing part of what God says is going to win God's favor? Well, sure. God says, let me remind you, that is not the case. Name that first child Jezreel. Are there people today who think that God is going to be compassionate no matter what, and that he's going to pull the punch in the last day, that he's going to be like a divine grandfather who's going to say, after all, I didn't really mean it. Yeah. Name that second one Lo-Ruhamah. Don't you think then I won't pull my compassion. And are the people who think that no matter what they do, they're still God's children. And He's still going to treat them just like they're His children. No matter what. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole doctrine of that. And God says, no, no, no. Name them, not my people. And so, you know, it's a wake-up call is what it is. Just like we were talking about with Joel, that God means business and that He will do the things that He has said He will do. Now, just like with Joel, there's a lot of hope remaining for the people. Beginning in verse 10, he says, "Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it is said to them, 'You are not my people,' it will be said to them, 'You are the sons of the living God.' And the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together, and I will point for them one leader, and they will go up from the land. For great will be the day of Jezreel. Say to your brothers, 'Am I,' and to your sister, 'Ruhamah.'" And so the idea there in chapter 2 is, you are my people, and you have received the compassion. But that phrase there, you are, where it was said to them, where it is said to them, you are not my people, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. I hope that's familiar to you. I hope you remember Peter making usage of that language over in 1 Peter chapter 2. And the idea, if we just want to put some pieces together here, the idea is, as Hosea looks forward and says, now look, God's distancing Himself and He's saying, you're not my people. He said, I'm pulling back my compassion. I'm bringing judgment for where you failed me. And all of that's coming to bear. But we're going to turn this around. And the ones that I have pushed away, the ones that I've said are not my people, I'm going to bring them in. Well, there's a sense in which that's going to include the remnant. It's going to include the righteous remnant of the Jews. But in another sense, it's like everybody is cut off, and then when God pulls them back, everybody's going to get scooped up in the pulling back. Romans chapter 11, I think, illustrates this really well. When you kind of conclude in all that God has to say to the Jews, that, you know, all that they've done, their betrayals of God, and that God has, they have not kept their covenant, and so their covenant has ceased, and now they must find salvation in Christ Jesus. But chapter 11, he starts talking about this tree. And basically all the branches have been cut off. And so the Jews want to get back in. They were natural branches. You know, they were growing off the tree naturally. What do they need to do to get back in? Same thing as the Gentiles. They got to be grafted in. And so, yes, they're going to have an opportunity to be called my people. So are we all going to have the opportunity to be called my people and the opportunity to have. So here, God is distancing Himself from these people and saying, look, when all of this is said and done, I'm going to set one leader in place. Well, who's that? Of course, that's Jesus Christ. I'm going to set one leader in place. And then we're going to be able to call it back together. And I'll be able to say, am I? You are my people. I'm going to say, Ruhamah, you do have compassion. And then he says this there in the end of chapter 3. Great will be the day of Jezreel. And I don't know for sure what all might be meant by that. But I think a possibility is this, that the idea of turning a moment of shame and a moment of judgment into a moment of victory is one that is very common throughout the prophets. And the language here, I think, is suggestive of that. So he's taking these names and he's turning them on their heads. So what he said to Israel in this way is going to be turned on its head. Well, maybe stretching the point, but I hope I'm not. I think it's, if we compare it to the other two being turned on their heads, here's a moment where the people have acted shamefully and brought judgment on themselves. And he uses that very word to say that day's going to be great. Can you think of a moment when Israel acted terribly shamefully and brought judgment on themselves, and that very moment turns into victory for them? I can. I can think of the Valley of Jezreel lining up real well with cross. And that on that day, Israel acted in such a way as to bring God's judgment on. And then what's the result? Well, God's mercy is the result. Victory is the result, even though they have deserved otherwise. Well, continuing on then in chapter 2, he tells Ammah now and Ruhamah to contend with your mother. Verse 2. Contend with your mother, contend, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. And let her put away her harlotry from her face, and her adultery from between her breasts. Or I will strip her naked and expose her as on the day when she was born. I will make her like a wilderness. I will make her like a desert land and slay her with thirst. Also, I will have no compassion on her children because they are children of harlotry. For their mother has played the harlot. She who convinced them, or conceived them rather, has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax and my oil and my drink. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. She will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. And she will seek them, but will not find them. And then she will say, I will go back to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. She does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore, I will take back my grain at harvest time, my new wine in its season. I will also take my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness, and I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one will rescue her out of my hand. I will also put an end to all her gaiety, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her festal assemblies. I will destroy her vines and fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. And I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field will devour them. I will punish her for the days of the Baals, when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adorn herself with her earrings and jewelry and follow her lovers, so that she forgot me, declares the Lord. And we get to see all that play out, unfortunately. God tells us what's going to happen, and he tells us, we'll see as we continue looking, he tells us all this. Tells them all of this so that it won't happen. But then it does. And what they do is it plays out just like God says. They think that their salvation is in the nations around them. They think their salvation is in the gods of the other nations. There's even times when they go and they conquer a nation and they still think that the other god may do some good for them. I don't understand that. And so they just attribute all these blessings from God to everybody and everything and everyone but God. And they say, look at what my lovers are doing for me. And I just tell you, when I read that passage there, verse 8, she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain and the new wine and the oil. That's grief right there. That is a God who is stricken in the heart. And what the book of Hosea does for us, among other things, is lets us see the grief of God. And lets us see that God is not indifferent to our behavior. He's not up there just going, you know, sort of calculating, say, well, if you do this, then this is what you get. You do this, this is what you get. And, you know, he's just sort of disconnected from it all. Brokenhearted. I can't believe they don't know that it's me that's supplying all of those things. And I think about that when people in this day and age talk about being thankful. I listen to a lot of podcasts and read a lot of books, self-help books and things of that nature. And I try to find some value in that. And one of the things that's fairly consistent across the board, if you want to be successful, you need to be a grateful person.
People who aren't grateful don't get anywhere. You don't have to look very far to see that that's a reality. People think they're owed something, you know, all those sorts of things. You know what's sad is when I listen to those things and read those things and they talk about being thankful. And they don't even know who to say be thankful to. They just want you to have a general attitude of gratitude. To who? We read a book to our daughters a few years ago, got a book about Thanksgiving. And it told the Thanksgiving story and about pilgrims and Indians and about Squanto and all of this. And all throughout it's talking about all the things that they were thankful for. And I got to the end and I said, what do y'all think about that? And the girl said, who are they thankful to? Because it didn't mention God once. You see, that's all. People are thankful to Mother Nature. People are thankful to maybe the government. That's a lark. I don't know. People are just thankful to something, anything. But not God. We're not any different. Our culture is not any different than these people right here. They're looking around everywhere and attributing blessings to any and everything but God. And God is up there saying, did they not know that all of those things come from me? And no, they don't. They have exchanged the Creator for the creature. Well, picking up then in chapter 3, we'll come back to verse 14 in chapter 2 in a moment. But here's God's instructions to Hosea. It says, the Lord said to me, to Hosea, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress. Even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. And I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be toward you. For the sons of Israel remain for many days without a king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, and without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. And they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. Can you imagine? Can you imagine a wife who brazenly, boldly walks out the door? Maybe Hosea says, where are you going? To my lovers. And God says, go get her. Go get her and bring her back. I'm going to tell you what. My thought is, I don't want her back. And if I think about that very much, I realize the peculiar position that we find ourselves in. That we do not suffer betrayal very much, very easily, very lightly. In our relationships with each other, we say, they have burnt it with me. And here we say, I don't want those people back. Why on earth does God want us back? We got no rights. We have no reason to be able to come in the door and ask him to take us back. And what he's doing here with Hosea is showing us, this is me, guys. I'm going to get them back. Not only that, but notice what he says here when he tells Hosea to go take her back. He says in verse 2 that Hosea bought her for himself with 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley. I don't know for sure what's going on here, but I've got an idea of a likely possibility. 30 shekels of silver is the price of a slave. We know that from the law. I was talking about those slave laws in Exodus 21. So in Exodus 21 and verse 23 is the price of a slave. So if you kill someone's slave, that's what you owe them. So in this instance, we got 15 shekels and a homer and a half of barley. And what it seems likely has happened is he's paid the money he's got, and what he doesn't have money for, he adds goods to go along with it. And what would that mean? That means she's so far gone, she has sold herself into slavery. Can you imagine? Not only go get her back, but pay for her. You go
buy her back. Does that sound familiar? Oh yeah. That's what we've done. We've sold ourselves into slavery. And God doesn't just go get us, but He pays the price. And dear is the price. 30 shekels of silver is what was paid for Him, incidentally. And He goes and puts Himself on the cross and pays the price to bring us back from the bondage that we have sold ourselves into. Well, that is a compelling picture, but it gets even more compelling. Go back to chapter 2 and verse 14. And here is a love song. It is written in poetry form. And beginning in verse 14, he says, "Therefore, behold, I will allure her." How am I going to win her back? This woman who has been unfaithful to me, and who has been bold and you know, untouched in her unfaithfulness, uncaring. He says, "I'm going to go allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak kindly to her." Well, I think if I found that my wife had been unfaithful to me, I wonder if my first words would be kindness. Words of allurement. I wonder if I would first think, what can I do to show her that I love her? But that's what God is saying right here. I want to allure her. I think sometimes when we're trying to win people over to God, we want to get them told. And God says here, that's not the approach I'm taking. I know God wants us to speak with boldness. I'm not saying that we put boldness to the side. But He wants us to be kind. And He wants us to allure. And that's what He is bringing to the table. Verse 15, "Then I will give her vineyards from there. I will give her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. And she will sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt." Verse 18, "In that day I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, the creeping things of the ground. And I will abolish the bow and the sword and the war and war from the land. And I will make them lie down in safety." I think these two verses speak to the idea that God is going to take things that once meant judgment, and He's going to use those things to offer her hope. Again, just like the Valley of Jezreel, now we have the Valley of Achor. And if you're familiar with the Valley of Achor, that is the valley that they took Achan down to. Remember Achan? So Achan's the man who took gold from Jericho when you weren't supposed to take anything out of Jericho. And then he stoned in the Valley of Achor. And so a place that means judgment, there is going to be a door of hope. And I'll make a covenant for them. And that covenant that is really a source of shame right now because it's so broken, He's going to repair that covenant. Well, verses 19 then picking up, "I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice and loving kindness and in compassion. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and then you will know the Lord." Ah, that idea of betrothal. So here is all of this unfaithfulness, this adultery, and what does God say? Let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to like when we were engaged. I don't know about you, but I've never committed adultery against my wife, and my wife has not committed adultery against me. And yet there are times that we say, "I wish we could go back." It's not to say we don't have a happy life and a happy marriage, but there are times when we look and we think, what a mess we made for so many years. How much wasted time there has been in acting foolishly. I wish I could go back to 2001, June 1st, take myself into a back room somewhere, shake myself, and say, you need to stop waiting on her to put you on a pedestal. And you go to supporting her. Oh, how many years are wasted. But I know that we learn from those years, and I know that our marriages can even get better from those years. But here's the point. Here is that in spite of all of this that's going on, God doesn't say, come back and I'll put you on a trial period. Come back and we'll see how it works out. No, he says, come back and we'll just start all over. Isn't that beautiful? Now, how many times is God going to let us do that? 7 times in a day? Up to 7 times 70? He'll say, let's just start over. Oh, we can just start over. And we don't have to worry about all the baggage. We don't have to worry about God bringing that back up and say, this is just like you always do. No. God says, we'll just go back to like when we were engaged. When we were a newly married couple. And then you'll know that I'm the Lord. You'll know the Lord. Well, back up to verse 16 then. It will come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you will call me Ishi and will no longer call me Baali. These two words are two Hebrew words that are translated husband. And if you look at the various contexts of when they're translated husband, the word Baali is the idea of the master of the house. It's the idea of a husband who has legal ownership of the wife. And then the idea of Ishi, that Hebrew word is used more in conjunction with affection. And so the idea is that you won't just call me, fine, we'll do what the master says. But the idea is, you love me. You love me because you know what I'm doing for you. And you'll be compelled to come back to me. Not constrained, not because I've locked you in. You see, that's what he says he's about to do, about to lock you in. And when you realize, hopefully when I take all those things away from you, when I put you over there in Babylon and you don't have anything, then when you come back, you'll see how precious this is. Now, here's the sad thing. It doesn't work. This never seems to work out for Israel. They always manage to forget. They always manage to start looking around at the other nations. I will say this. After God sends them away into captivity, they come back. They do seem to lose some of their affinity for idolatry, but not for second-rate service, which they continue to offer. And we'll talk about that when we get to the book of Malachi. What about you? When you look through that, I'll tell you what it does for me. First of all, it just makes me all that God's compassion towards me. It makes me realize that God's judgment and His compassion are so intermingled. The goodness and the severity of God. Notice here, just like in the book of Joel, you don't see two different gods. You see the same God saying, this is what I'm going to do. Why? So that I can help you. You ever felt like that with somebody? He said, let me help you. And you just want to shake them. And that's kind of where God is here. But then He's coming back tenderly. Compassionately, and you see those things work hand in hand, and what God wants us to see is both aspects, that we fear His wrath and that we are compelled by His compassion. Another thing that it makes me do is recognize that I need more compassion. I think of it in terms of just the husbands and wives, you know, this adds weight to the teaching that Paul does in Ephesians chapter 5 when he tells husbands to love their wives as Christ loved the church. And just stack this on top of that. So not only has Christ loved the church, but as God loved His people even back then. He's been illustrating that for a lot longer than just since the New Testament began to be written. Sometimes I think husbands and wives, we think we're justified in mistreating our spouses. Somebody says, well, you don't understand. Can you imagine bringing your complaints, whatever they may be about your spouse, and bringing them to God right here and saying, let me tell you about what my wife is doing. God says, oh, let me tell you about what you do. And how many times I take you back. Not just take you back, but with open arms. And wipe the slate clean over and over and over again. And we hold such petty grudges in our marriages. But not just in our marriages, expanded past that. And our compassion with brethren and our compassion with people in general. We run out of patience. And somehow we think we're justified. Can you imagine looking at the cross? Can you imagine walking up to the cross of Jesus Christ while he's there suffering in agony and saying, let me tell you about the people in my life, Jesus. It just doesn't look very good, does it? And that's where I am when I look at the book of Hosea. Is that Hosea going through all this? He can't turn to God and say, you don't know what this is like. God's saying, I know exactly what that's like. That's me. And how God could go through that with people from the beginning of time up to now and still be the God of love that he is and not be a God who just wipes us out is beyond me. And I hope it's compelling to you. I hope it softens us and helps us see people with the eyes of God. It is a great task. Well, here's the thing though. When it comes to Gomer, God makes all of these offers. And he is so willing to have her back, so willing to compel her to come back. She representing Israel there. But let me tell you, when she doesn't, then it's Lo Ruhamah, and it's Lo Ammi. No compassion. You're not my people. So you may be sitting there tonight, and you may be all at the very goodness of God, the grace of God. But don't be like the Jews who Paul said had despised the goodness of God. They thought that God allowing them to continue to exist meant that God was fine with whatever they did. He said, time's up. And there are people here tonight who may be looking at God's grace and go, well, I'm okay. No, don't take that message away. Take the message away that if you come to him, you're okay. If you put your faith in him, you're okay. You come back into his vineyard. But if after all of that, and after he has paid the price, after he's put his son on the cross, then you walk right back out that door, what he's saying here is, we're done. That's what he says to those children. Go tell her. Go tell your mama. It's about to be over. So I hope that you see the balance there, the goodness and severity. And I hope you're responsive to the goodness and the severity of God this evening. You can put off the hard taskmaster of sin and put on the light burden of Christ. Come to know the Lord. Wipe the slate clean. Whatever way that we can help you do that this evening, won't you respond while we stand and while we sing?